And we're with Lawrence Gonzalez. We're talking about a couple of his works. One, Flight 232. You just heard the incredible story of heroism and survival. And then we're going to get into surviving survival. What happens to those people who go through these incredible tragedies? What happens in their lives afterwards? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Lawrence Gonzalez with us. Lawrence, so what did we learn about Flight 232? We learned, I would assume, incredible crew work, changing some technology, but what else did we learn?
Well, we learned, I think, ultimately about the amazing resilience of the human spirit. All these people on board, almost 300 people on board, and I interviewed all these survivors, and not just the survivors who were on board, but those who were on the ground helping too, because they went through just as much as the people on board the plane did, surprisingly, I think.
Yeah.
And we learned, gosh, you know, people really are heroic. People really do have inner strength, and they can call on these resources that you just don't know exist until you're faced with one of these situations that forces you to call on those resources. So, you know, I came away from this experience with just a renewed faith in humanity, frankly.
Were they given counseling or any psychiatric help afterward?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. People were offered all sorts of help, and many people were helped by that. Some, you know, just one lady I know who worked in the morgue, and she had to deal with terrible, terrible things in the morgue. And she was just an ordinary housewife. She worked as a switchboard operator and, you know, had never thought about such things before. And she volunteered and wound up in this incredibly grisly situation. And she said every night she went home to her husband, who was a part of the Air National Guard and was also volunteering, and the two of them just talked to each other. She said they showered off and tried to get the smell of burning fuel off of them, and then just sat and consulted with each other and kind of became their own therapist. So some people managed it on their own. Some people got professional help. Some people, frankly, never got over it.
Here we are a week away from 25 years. And tell me about those who could never get over it. I would assume, and even with those of you you've interviewed for these works, it's pretty darn emotional for them, isn't it?
Yeah, tremendously so. And I'll tell you, the people I interviewed ran the gamut from one end to the other. On one end, there's a guy out in Ohio I know was on the flight, rescued a bunch of people, truly a hero. And I said, so how did this affect your life? And he said, no, it didn't affect my life. I just kind of went on. I've got other things to think about. And then as we proceeded with the interview, he actually broke down and cried. And he said, I didn't realize that I had all these emotions still in the back of my brain somewhere. And so everybody has an emotional residue from this, but different people manage their lives differently and get on with things differently. And it's not a judgment on them. Everybody's just different. But there are some people I interviewed who literally to this day are suffering from PTSD from it. And there were people involved. There was one man named Thomas Randolph who was with the police. He was with the Department of Public Safety, Department of Criminal Investigation in Iowa, and he was charged with photographing all the bodies as they came into the morgue. So he sat, and if you look at the book, Flight 232, there's 16 pages of color photographs in there, and there's a photograph of Tom sitting up on a ladder with his camera. And as the bodies came in, he was supposed to photograph them, and he did. He was also charged with helping to extract the bodies from the burned-out fuselage. There were people trapped in the fuselage, burned beyond recognition, and Tom had to help get them out of there. And then he was also charged with working in the morgue. And this experience destroyed him, according to his friends, and this is described in the book. And he just never got over it. He couldn't get beyond it. And the poor guy suffered greatly. And he wasn't on the plane, you know. So everybody's different. But one of the things that I learned in in writing my previous book, Surviving Survival, is that two things. Everybody goes through some kind of trauma in life. Nobody gets off scot-free.
That's right. There's always a tragedy somehow. That's part of living.
Yes, exactly. There's the death of, you know, your parents, let's say, or worse, the death of some other loved one. There's illness, there's accident, there's all these things that impinge on us. And the question is, how are we going to react to it? How are we going to cope with it? And I think that's what I've tried to address in my work, which is, can we do a little better and make ourselves not suffer so much?
Well, you know, the living experience, Lawrence, also includes the tragedy of life.
Yeah.
Many of these things you've just mentioned. I mean, I would hope to God most of us don't go through a plane crash episode, but I went through, when I was 18, a car crash. I was going to school. I was going to the University of Detroit, and my dad had given me his older Mercury car. I don't think they make Mercuries anymore. And I was driving, and it was a little slick, and the freeway was a little hilly. And so I went up the hill and back down. It was, I hydroplaned into a group of cars that had already stopped for a previous accident. And there was nothing I could do. Nothing I could do. When you hydroplane, it's like you're on ice. And into this other car, I rammed. And there were no seatbelts then. I bounced off the steering wheel. I didn't think I was hurt. Called up my father, went to a payphone and said, you know, Dad, the car smashed up. And he said, are you okay? And I said, yeah. And I took off from going to school that day, going to college. But this episode, I thought I had gotten over. You know, I was fine. I walked away from it. Everything's cool. Your body does something, and your head does something to you. Because I would start getting nightmares. I would go out to dinner with my girlfriend, who eventually became my sweetheart wife with the mother of my kids. We'd go out to dinner, and I couldn't eat. My stomach was upset. This happened for about a month. So I can imagine what it's like for people to go through a plane crash episode and have to endure that afterward.
Yeah, and people are amazingly resilient. I, as I said earlier, I am surprised with the number of people I interviewed involved in Flight 232 and how few of them were just stopped in their tracks and their lives were derailed. Many of them had to cope. Many of them had to make adjustments. Many of them had to sort of reinvent their lives a little bit. But, gee, the amount of just recovering and going on is just astounding. And it, as I say, it gives me new faith in humanity.
You know, there's a saying from that great movie, Shawshank Redemption, get busy living or get busy dying.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have that. They have to take a stand and make a choice, don't they?
And I want people to know that, for example, one of the big characters in the book Flight 232 is Susan White. She was a flight attendant, 25 years old at the time, a wonderful person, full of energy and life, and just loved her work, loved people. Everybody loves Susan, a bubbly, wonderful person. And she went through this crash, very nearly lost her life, saw terrible things, helped people, did heroic things, and came out of this and was pretty okay. And she went to counseling, and she went through some adjustments and, you know, kind of recovered herself and went back to work as a flight attendant. But get this, when the World Trade Center was attacked on 9/11, she went completely nuts and went completely back to PTSD type symptoms.
She lost it. That episode probably pulled something out of her.
It triggered something that was buried in her emotional system, and she had to go through her recovery all over again.
I mean, you're right. I mean, I've talked to some people who know people who are in New York at that time, near that building, those buildings, and they said that they could hear people splat when they jumped because they could not endure the heat and the flames, and they had no way out. They had to jump.
Yeah. Well, I was there 9/11. Just a couple of days after it happened, I saw it. I was at home and I saw it happen. I live in the Chicago area, and I got in my car and I drove out there, and teamed up with a photographer, an old friend of mine, and went to Ground Zero, and was there for many days, and interviewed people. And I talked to one guy who said he watched. He worked in one of the buildings nearby. He watched as a man came out the window and got in between the metal structure of the, you know, the World Trade Center had these vertical metal braces on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was sort of doing a chimney move. It's a mountaineering move. He had his feet up against one side and his back up against the other and was sort of shimmying his way down, right. And he came from about, I don't know, 70, 80 floors up, all the way down to about 30 before he lost his strength and fell.
Ugh.
And they watch these things. Oh, my goodness. But, you know, in New York City, even some World War II veterans were triggered by that. They had never had PTSD symptoms or problems after World War II, and yet the World Trade Center set them off and sent them into this spiral of emotional reactions. So these things live inside of us forever, and it's just a question of how we manage them, and we have to learn to do that.
Well, you're right. In Surviving Survival, I mean, people go through all kinds of different stress episodes. A divorce to one person, he may say, hey, you know what? We got divorced. That's the way it is, and they move on with their lives. Other people, it's devastating.
Yeah.
Losing a job. Somebody may say, hey, I'm going to go out and get a new job. The heck with this one.
Yeah.
Other people, it's like losing a member of the family or a limb on their body.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for people. I guess it's the complexity of who they are, their makeup.
Right.
It's different for different people, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I want to tell you about a couple of circuits in the brain that I talk about in Surviving Survival that are very important in this and can help people in coping with it, no matter what their reaction is. And I want you to picture a cat. You know, you have a pet cat, and the pet cat's walking around your kitchen, and you're cooking dinner, and you take a step and accidentally step on the cat's tail.
He won't like that.
Everybody knows what's going to happen, right? Everybody can picture what happens when you accidentally step on the cat's tail. Well, the cat screams and bares its teeth and struggles and leaps and has this really stereotypical reaction that we're all familiar with. And this is an ancient circuit in the brain of mammals. It's called the rage circuit.
The reptilian brain.
Yes. It's a very ancient circuit, and we all have it. And, you know, if you drop a cinder block on your toe, you will activate this circuit. You don't have any control over it.
It's a survival circuit.
Yes, it is. That's correct. So if you're attacked by a predator, you will struggle and scream and fight, and maybe you'll get away. This is a good strategy. So I talk about this in Surviving Survival, right? Okay, so that's one circuit in the brain. Now, another thing that a cat does that we're all familiar with is a cat stalks prey. So you can watch a cat out in your backyard, and it's weighed low to the ground, and it's moving very slowly, and it's being very methodical, and it's looking at a bird that it wants to eat, right? So this cat is engaged in another stereotypical behavior that's very ancient in our brains, and we contain that too in our brains, and this is called the seeking circuit. Now, the seeking circuit and the rage circuit use some of the same parts of the brain. But the trick is, you can't do both at once. So the cat is not going to be an effective hunter if it's screaming and, you know, struggling and flopping around. It's going to scare its prey away, right? So it has to disable that behavior in order to stalk prey. So in that lies the secret to dealing with trauma. Because what people have found, just by instinct, is that if they engage themselves in some sort of seeking circuit behavior, like knitting, like golf, like running, like walking, playing a musical instrument, learning a new language, anything that is stereotypical organized behavior, sort of rhythmic pattern behavior, it stops this rage circuit.
Tell us the case of Debbie Kiley, Brad Kavanaugh. They were sailors. They were stranded out at sea. What did they go through?
Yeah, Debbie Kiley was a sailor. She was a competitive sailor, a very good sailor. And she hired on a ship to just deliver a ship. And her friend Brad Kavanaugh was another crew member. And they got into a hurricane and their ship sank. And they wound up in a small, semi-rigid boat, just drifting. They had no survival supplies. They had nothing. And they were basically dying of thirst.
Now, did people know they were out there somewhere?
And nobody really knew where they were. The Coast Guard did some searching, but it was not very effective. So they were basically on their own. And by chance, a Russian freighter stumbled upon them, and they were rescued finally. But they were out there for 5 days. They were there with three other people. One of them was the captain, one of them was the first officer, and one of them was the captain's girlfriend, who shouldn't have been on board anyway. But the captain's girlfriend was badly injured and died after a couple of days. The captain and the first officer drank seawater and went insane.
Oh, because of the salt water, right?
Because of the salt water, correct.
Yeah.
And they both did the same thing, the captain first. He said he started having hallucinations. He thought he was near shore. He said, "I'm going to go get the car. I'm sick of this. I'm going to go get the car, and I'll see you guys later." And he went over the side and swam away. And they could hear him screaming as he was eaten by sharks, which had been circling their little dinghy the whole time. And after a while, the other guy, the first officer, said, "I got to get some cigarettes. I'm going to the 7-Eleven." And he went over the side too. And he was eaten by sharks underneath the boat. So the boat was being flipped in the air. And Debbie and Brad were just holding on for dear life, trying not to get thrown in the water. So this was a terrible, terrible experience. And
they lasted as long as they could, too, didn't
they? Yeah. They were just about on the point of death when this Russian freighter came along and picked them up, and they survived. And so Debbie Kiley went through, you know, terrible, terrible consequences as a result of this. She was rescued. She was okay. And yet she found it really difficult to get back to her life and had to go through a lot of machinations to create a life for herself that she could live.
Lawrence, do they go through a spiritual change too?
I think so. I really do think so. I mean, people who have been through things like this realize, wow, we really do live a contingent life. You know, your life is not guaranteed to you. You can walk out the door this morning and get hit by a bus and be lying there in the gutter thinking, "Gosh, I should have had that milkshake, huh?"
Yeah, a couple of them.
Life is not guaranteed to any of us. I have myself seen people killed just by chance. I mean, I was at an intersection, stopped at a light, just, you know, on an ordinary day. My wife and I had gone to visit her mother, and we were on our way home, and I was just stopped at a traffic light, and this man came through the intersection on a scooter, motor scooter, and somebody turned left in front of him.
Bang.
And he hit the car, he went flying, he lay in the middle of the intersection, and he died. And this was a good guy. This was a guy who worked for Microsoft. He had a kid, he had a wife, his wife was a doctor. He was doing all the right things, trying to save some money, you know, on the motor scooter, not driving his car. He was wearing a helmet. You know, he's doing everything right, and he's dead.
And he's dead. I want to ask you, when it's your time, is it your time, Lawrence, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM? Well, next hour, you'll take your phone calls and your survival stories. And when I come back, more with Lawrence Gonzalez as we talk about Flight 232 and surviving survival. With Lawrence Gonzalez, Lawrence, are you a believer when it's your time, it's your time?
Yeah, I think so. There's an interesting thing in the book Flight 232. A lady named Joan Wernick traveling with her husband, Pete Wernick. They're a bluegrass couple. They have a band that travels around. Very good musicians. And she's very religious and he's not. But when I interviewed her, she said, you know, my mother used to say, you get the grace of the present moment. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, when your time is up, your time is up. And at that moment, you're going to go into this really peaceful state. And I was astonished that she said this because so many people on that flight told me when the plane was crashing and they thought, now I'm going to die, they felt very serene. They didn't feel afraid. They felt this peace come over them like they were in the hands of God. And whether they were religious people or not, they felt this calm center to everything. And I thought that was a fascinating thing at the moment of death. One lady, Chief Flight Attendant Jan Brown, was engulfed in fire. And she said, at that moment, I thought, okay, this is how I'm dying. I'm burning to death. And yet she said she just felt this total peace and calm surround her.
When these episodes have occurred, specifically the plane crash, do people end up going back flying?
Yes, almost everybody. Now, there are some exceptions, but I'm just astonished, frankly, at how many people just got back on the horse. And as I say, there are exceptions. But, you know, I have to tell you...
They probably figure, well, it's not going to happen again.
Well, first of all, there's the... One guy from Wyoming said to me, look, I've been in my plane crash. I'm not going to get in another plane crash. It's not going to happen. So he took that attitude. But I have to tell you, and I want your audience to know, flying is really safe. You know, commercial airliners in first world countries just don't crash.
It's safer than driving.
Driving is terrible. Driving is awful. You know, if they invented driving today, it would be outlawed. It kills like 40,000 people a year. Flying is so safe. When I'm in an airplane at 37,000 feet with a cup of coffee and a good book, I am as happy as a clam because I know nothing's going to happen. It's more likely that you're going to win the lottery 3 days in a row than that you're going to get in an air crash. So, you know, I would advise our listeners to just relax on an airplane because it's really safe. However, an airplane is a machine, and occasionally things go wrong.
Right. That is so true. And if maintenance is bad, if something's shoddy, look out.
Yeah, or if you happen to be in a, you know, Malaysia, let's say.
Well, see, in those particular cases, I don't think the maintenance is very good.
Yep.
And who knows what happened on that.
Yep.
That's a pretty reliable plane, isn't it?
Which one?
The
777,
yeah.
Yeah, but Boeing makes terrific products. I love Boeing products. It's a great plane, and I don't fault the plane. But, you know, humans, this is, goes back to what we were talking about, the chaplain on board, I mean, not on board, but the chaplain who dealt with Flight 232, Greg Clapper, who says, we're humans, we're fallible, you know, we make machines that break.
How do you explain, Lawrence, the episodes where people are ready to get on a plane and something overcomes them and they say, I'm not going, and that plane ends up crashing,
yeah,
and they were saved, like your situation?
Yes. Well, and this is something that I'm writing about in a new book, which is essentially a book about memory. You know more than you know you know. So the people have often said, you know, you only really use 10% of your brain. Well, that's not true. You use all your brain. But a very small portion of your brain is conscious, and everything else is going on beneath the surface. So when you're a little kid, you start recording things in your brain, even before birth. When you're in the womb, you begin recording things, and you record these things all your life, and it all stays there. Nothing gets lost unless you have brain damage. It's all there, but it's not all available to your conscious mind. It's all there feeding information to your decision-making process. And your decision-making process, as I talk about in deep survival and in surviving survival, your decision-making process is not always a conscious, logical thing. It's being fed from this subterranean source of memories that tell you what was good in the past, what was bad in the past, how should I make this decision now? And there are neuroscientists who study this. Antonio Damasio is one of them, who study if people get brain damage and they can't get access to these unconscious memories, they start to lose the ability to make decisions at all. So he'll say to one of these brain damaged patients, you know, let's meet next week. When would you like to meet, Wednesday or Thursday? And the guy will go on and on, not be able to decide because he's lost contact with this unconscious source of gut feelings. That's what gut feelings mean.
What would you say, Lawrence, with your work in Flight 232, for example, might be the greatest message you can convey to people?
The greatest message that I got out of doing this, which I think is the message that I want to convey, is to have faith in the human spirit, because people rise to the occasion and they astonish you. These are ordinary people. The people that I write about in Flight 232, you know, one guy is like a corporate auditor and another guy is some sort of communications executive and another person drills oil wells.
But there were heroes. They stepped up to the plate.
And they stepped up in this amazing situation. Now picture yourself, you get on a plane, beautiful day, supposed to be a perfectly smooth ride, middle of summer, get on a plane, you're being served nice food, you're watching a interesting video, everything's going good, and then all of a sudden you're faced with death.
Your life changes instantly.
Your life changes in a second. And what do you do? You know, do you run screaming from the room? No, these people stayed behind in this plane. It's upside down. It's burning. And these people stayed behind, and they picked up this Felician nun. There was a woman on board who was a nun, and she was an older woman and couldn't walk. And these people stayed behind. The plane's on fire. They're picking her up. They're helping her out. She's saying her rosary while they're doing this. I mean, these ordinary people just turned into heroes in a second.
Were there some that fled, like the movie Titanic, where, you know, that one guy dressed up like a girl, a woman, to try to get on the little ship to take off?
You know, I saw that movie, and and I know that's possible, but I have talked to so many people in the crash of Flight 232, and I never saw any of that.
There were no cowards there.
I did not see it. You know, I talked to just a zillion people, and I just did not see that. I saw people coming together, helping each other, and frankly, I can't imagine it. I mean, I can't imagine myself doing this. So you're upside down. You're hanging from your seatbelt. The plane has crashed. The plane's filling with smoke. There's fire everywhere. I pop my seatbelt. I fall on my head. Now what do? Well, I would run screaming from the room, I would think, right?
I would look around me, see if there's anybody who needs help, and then get out of there.
And I see people stopping and just helping and helping and helping and helping. And I mentioned earlier, Jerry Schemmel, you know, actually went back into the plane.
Yeah, that's amazing.
When it's on fire.
It could have blown up.
Yeah, and so you know, my takeaway from this is, you know, with all the bad stuff going on in the world, people have this core of goodness in them that we can call on under the right circumstances. And it gives you faith. It makes you want to go ahead and live.
Do you think these people, these heroes, break down later emotionally?
Yes. Everybody I've talked to at some point breaks down. I don't mean breaks down and stops living, but I mean at least
You cry.
Yeah. You know, the controller, the manager of the tower, control tower at Sioux City, he went for hours and hours and hours and hours through this crash and then through the aftermath of the crash where all these news helicopters were coming and all this traffic coming through. And he just worked and worked and worked till late at night and didn't show any emotion at all and got home and just burst into tears. And that was pretty typical of the people I talked to, that they would, you know, they'd step up to the plate and they'd do what needed to be done in the moment. And then later, when things calmed down, they would just
break down.
Yeah, they would let it out, let the emotion out.
That's probably the human part of them. There's that mechanism that kicks in where they have no fear and they're able to do what they do. I think a lot of that happens on the battlefield, too.
Yeah.
I, you know, spent 9 years in the Navy. No battlefield for me. I didn't do any of that. But I can see some of the people in Iraq or Afghanistan, the true heroes, doing what they have to do in battle. But then when they have a moment, when they're back at their barrack or something, I bet it kicks in.
Yeah. And I saw a lot of that with Flight 232. You know, people are, they come out of the airplane. Plane's broken, the plane's on fire, people are dying. They come out of the airplane, they're so high on adrenaline that they just feel invincible. And many people describe this to me, like, I'd never been so happy in all my life, I couldn't believe I was alive. But then a while later, whether it's hours or in one case, the guy went about 58 hours on this high and then just broke down.
You did something differently in 232. You list the chapters. This is what I wanted to ask you. You list the chapters, but you don't give them a name.
Yeah.
You just go chapter one, page three, you know, like that.
And, you know, I thought about naming these chapters, and everything seemed too hokey. The story itself in Flight 232 is so intense and so emotional that I thought I just want to give people a kind of roadmap so they don't get lost in this big book, so they can just have some kind of, you know, orientations, like kind of the way streets are named, Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C. And beyond that, I didn't want to put any additional emotion on top of it because there's too much emotion already. So you read this book. So I want to say that writing this book was like getting on the flight. You can get on, but you can't get off. Once I started writing this book, I realized, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to go right to the end of this, and there's nothing I can do. And my wife laughed at me because I'd be up at 4 in the morning writing, and she'd say, come on, you know, don't you want to live life? I'm like, no, I've got to finish this. And I hope that I designed the book so that it reads that way.
Well, you write it as if you were a passenger.
Yeah, yes. And so when people get on this book, when I give people this book, I say, don't start it late at night because you won't get any sleep.
You know, I'm in a lot of turbulence sometimes these days. There's something going on with the jet stream. And, you know, when I think about these other planes that have had severe mechanical issues, I just say, you know what? This is only turbulence. This thing's going to fly right through it. And they always do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, and I say this in the book, I mean, I have tremendous admiration for the people who design and run our system of flight in this country. It's just an amazing thing they do. General Electric makes the best engines. I love United Airlines. You know, all these people are doing a great job. And this is an anomaly, the crash of this flight. And yet, the reason I wrote about it is not to put blame on somebody for crashing a plane. It's because it contains the most intense human drama I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. What about these lithium batteries that we hear so much about these days?
Well, lithium batteries are a deal with the devil, you know. It's a wonderful resource of energy, and yet they have this inherent flaw, which is if they happen to cook, they provide their own oxygen. So the chemical reaction that takes place when they burn produces oxygen, which makes them burn even hotter, and so it's a bad scene. You can't just, you know, douse them with a normal fire extinguisher and expect them to go out. So it's a little tricky. But, you know, like so many technologies, the technology of flight is a little tricky. You've got to create this titanium to make these spinning wheels that will put the plane in the air and keep it moving. And yet titanium is this very dodgy metal that is subject to contamination. I think we're moving into an era of synthetic materials like composites that will replace the titanium and may make flying even safer.
Did all of the crew on 232 survive?
Well, yes, except for one flight attendant, Rene LeBeau. It's a very, very sad story. Rene LeBeau was 23 years old. She'd been flying just for 7 months. She was brand new. Beautiful, beautiful young woman, striking red hair with a blue ribbon in it, and was not even supposed to be on that flight, except the flight was so full she was called in
to help out.
To help out, because they needed more help. And Rene lost her life, and I just can't tell you how. I spoke to Renee's dad. I communicated with her dad when I was first starting out on this project. And I said, you know, I would like to include her story in this. And he said, yes, okay, I'll cooperate. And he never could do it. I mean, he couldn't.
Just too emotional for him?
Yeah, I have two daughters, I have to say, grown daughters, beautiful young women. My older daughter has a 2.5-year-old son, fabulous little grandson of ours. And I just can't imagine what Renee's dad has gone through all these years. It's just almost unspeakable to think about. And yet, well...
You sound emotional on this one.
Well, yeah, it has been a very emotional thing to write this book, because I've been in these people's lives who went through this, and Renee especially touches my heart because she's like one of my daughters. And, you know, it's really hard.
That's tragic. Well, there will be other crashes, too. That's the sad part, Lawrence.
Well, and just as I was, you know, finishing up here, Malaysia Flight 370 went down, God knows where, and all of a sudden I'm being asked, like, what happened? What happened? I don't know. I don't know what happened. I had never heard of something like that. I mean, in 40 years of writing about airline safety, and
this one's bizarre.
This is so bizarre. And my wife sort of jokingly said, well, the Malaysian Air Force was out on maneuvers and accidentally shot the plane down, and that's why we're not hearing anything about
it. We're hearing all kinds of stories like that. And you know what? The media, too, has somewhat forgotten this story now. It's gone away. I mean, CNN went wall-to-wall too much, but now they've completely forgotten about it.
Have you heard the? I consulted with my sources in the National Transportation Safety Board at the time that the flight went missing, and they didn't have an answer. It's all speculation, but they said the only thing that makes sense to us is that it was an onboard fire.
Well, that I've heard, but we keep forgetting about the two occupants, passengers who had stolen passports.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
That is a denominator that they have not talked about.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And we really can't know anything.
No, not at all. Lawrence, the book Flight 232 available now, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Everywhere that books are available, people can go to my website, which is flight232.com or lawrencegonzalez.com. Either way, we'll get you to the same place. And it'll give you choices of how to order it. Or you can just go to your online or brick-and-mortar store.
Okay, we're going to come back and take phone calls for you, questions. But also, if you have a survival story that you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear it. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.